In the spirit of hope and optimism that comes with the start of a new year, we're devoting the next several editions of Please Explain to an exploration of our most pressing problems for life on Earth and the most promising solutions for dealing with them. Please Explain How to Save the World is our series within a series, and today's edition is about water. Joining us now are Dr. Manu Lal, the Alan and Carol Silberstein Professor of Engineering at Columbia University and the Director of the Columbia Water Center. He is a hydroclimatologist and a senior research scientist with the International Research Institute for Climate and Society, and Sandra Postel, the founder and director of the Global Water Policy Project, the National Geographic Society's Freshwater Fellow, and the lead water expert for the Society's Freshwater Initiative. Very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you very much, Leonard. Pleasure to be here.
Water issues are so complex, it's hard to know where to begin, but let's take a stab at it. Manu, can you help us visualize and understand the workings of water on the planet? What is the volume of water on Earth?
We have a lot of water on Earth. Unfortunately, most of it is in the oceans. 97% of the water is in the oceans, and if we present it as a number, people estimate that the total amount of water on the planet is about 14 billion cubic kilometers. It sounds like a lot, right?
Now, that's 97% in the oceans. Has it always been that much, or has there been more fresh water in the past?
Well, there's always variations in the amount of fresh water that's available as a function of climate, but by and large, you know, this number is pretty stable for at least the period we consider humans to have been around.
Now, so we have 3%, Sandra, 3% of the water on Earth drinkable or consumable because it's fresh water, or is much of that fresh water undrinkable as well?
Well, a lot of it's not available. You know, we've got just about 97% in the oceans. What's remaining, two-thirds of that is fresh, but it's locked up in glaciers and ice caps. And so, you know, of that small 3%, two-thirds of it is ice. And so there's a very small share, less than 1%, that's fresh and able to meet the needs of humans as well as every other living creature that needs fresh water. So it's a very tiny share of all the water on Earth that we can really consider fresh and usable.
And how much of that fresh water has been polluted by human activity?
Well, that's a very hard question because there's all kinds of pollution. Much of the fresh water is underground, and of course that's particularly hard to get a fix on in terms of how much we're polluting groundwater. But certainly in terms of rivers, which we depend on for a great deal of our needs for drinking and industry and agriculture, there are many indications that we have serious pollution, both from industrial uses of water, where you have discharges of industrial waste, for example, into rivers and lakes, as well as from agriculture, where you have fertilizers and pesticides. And where we look, in our country, the U.S. Geological Survey does a good job of measuring the constituents of groundwater and river water, and they typically find evidence of nitrogen and phosphate pollution as well as pesticides and other contaminants in most places they look. So certainly pollution is a growing concern.
Upmanu, how many people don't have access to fresh water?
This is also a difficult question because it depends on how you count it. In one respect, everybody in the world has access to fresh water because otherwise they would be dead. So the question really is, what's the quality and the quantity of access that's available to people? And in terms of standards or metrics that people at the United Nations, for example, or other groups have set, then you're looking at large numbers of people who do not have access at the standards that people consider minimum for, you know, decent survival. And that way, the numbers are about 1 billion people lacking access to safe drinking water, and maybe about 2.5 to 3 billion people lacking access for all services that water provides for them.
So those billion people who don't have access to clean drinking water, what do they do? Are they just drinking dirty water, water that's going to make them ill?
Yeah, that's essentially the situation, that they either don't have access to as much water as they need, of high quality, or indeed they are drinking polluted water. And that applies to other life forms as well, not just humans.
Well, other life forms can't go to a hotel and get potable water. We can, or they can't buy clean water at the local supermarket. So is that having a real impact on life on the planet, other than human life?
Well, you know, the thing that one colleague mentioned to me a few years ago was that despite all the water and other environmental impacts that are going on, he's impressed with what happens in India, because there's not really a collapse of the biosystems or life there. But that has changed in the last 10 years. In the major rivers in India, major rivers of the world, as a matter of fact, the Ganges, there's been a significant loss of biodiversity or the different species that live there. So we are seeing finally, environmental collapse, and much of it can be related to water.
Now, Sandra, what about climate change? We've been hearing about the melting of the ice caps on mountains and such. They were a major source of fresh water. What's happening now? Are we going to see less and less fresh water available as a result of climate change?
Climate change is an added dimension to this that's very important. It's sort of a wild card here. The issue with climate change is that it's bringing us to a new normal with water, and we don't know exactly what that new normal is going to look like. You know, there's tremendous variability over time with water supply through the hydrologic cycle. But what we're entering now is a period of extreme new variability outside of the normal bounds. You can think of, you know, the variability as an envelope, and variation happens historically within that envelope, and we plan for those extremes and so on. Well, we're now outside that envelope, is what hydrologists are telling us. And so we're going to have more dry periods and more extreme dry periods, and we're going to have wetter periods and more extreme wet periods. So floods and droughts are likely to become more challenging. So we're moving into this period that's unfamiliar to us. And so adapting to that is going to be a big challenge. You know, the rule of thumb generally is dry areas are likely to get drier, wet areas are likely to get wetter, so floods and droughts. And this, you know, creates enormous challenges for managing and using water. You know, will the levees hold? Will the dam be adequate to store the water? Where do we build a dam? How do we manage this? And so it's creating big challenges and new challenges. I particularly worry about the impact of climate and water together on the food supply. Because we've developed an irrigation system and a rain-fed agricultural system that depends on the current stable climate that we've enjoyed, stable again within that normal variation. And now we're going to be outside that. And if you think about this past year, just looking at 2011, we had some very, very unusual and extreme weather events. We had this heat in Russia that knocked off 40% of Russia's wheat crop. We had the floods in Pakistan, drought in China, droughts and floods in Australia, all of which are impacting food production. And when you get a lot of them happening at once, you can have a spike in food prices, which is what we saw in 2008 and again last year. And this leads to social and political implications and often instability. We've seen food riots in Haiti and Senegal and Mauritania and a half dozen other countries when you have this spiking of food prices. And so This sort of confluence of water scarcity, rising population, rising demand for food, with climate change now on top of it, I think creates a lot of concern about food security for the years ahead.
And so, Upamanu, would you say we're on the brink of or in the midst of what's being called a global water crisis?
I think we are in the midst of a global water crisis.
So we've passed the tipping point?
Well, I don't know. I'm actually quite optimistic that we can turn the corner and that we can use the situation that we find ourselves in as an impetus to more responsible resource management and a better future for both humans and other forms of life. I wanted to amplify a bit on Sandra's response to the climate change issue. There are many people who have difficulty accepting that there is climate change. So what I would like to say is that, actually, let's not even go there. If we look at the climate we have experienced in the last 1,000 years from proxies that are available to us, and we look at the frequency of droughts and floods that was experienced over that period, some of which led to significant changes in society and the collapse of civilizations or radical changes in the balance of power. And we bring that and overlay that on today's environment, today's societies and populations, we are not prepared for that. So whether or not you believe in climate change, if you look at the range of climate variability in the last 2,000 years or 1,000 years or 500 years, as opposed to just the last century, we are already looking at a situation that we really have to be careful about. But on the other side of it, I think that through technology and through more responsible management, we will not have a problem for at least the next 20 to 50 years.
Well, that's not all that long. That's a cause for optimism.
Well, yes, because if you don't go there, I think the scenarios for the next 10 to 20 years look horrific.
Well, we've been talking about, Sandra, you mentioned flooding in certain areas, desertification in others. Can't we just take the water that's flooding now that didn't flood in the past and move it to the areas that need water? Or is that too complicated?
It's a good question. It would be nice to be able to move water around, but it's very, very bulky and very, very energy intensive and therefore very expensive, you know, to do that. You know, of course we do move water around. If you look at California, for example, Los Angeles just couldn't exist without moving water to it from Northern California and from the Colorado River system. You
know, which is drying up.
Yes, and so we're moving water hundreds of miles from a couple different directions in order to supply Los Angeles. Same thing with Phoenix and Tucson and many, many other what I would call oasis cities around the world that exist only because we're bringing water to them. But rarely do we move water more than, you know, a few hundred miles. And again, it's very energy intensive. And so as we move into this period of higher oil prices and higher energy prices generally, water gets more complicated. You know, how do we get it to people in an affordable way? And so this idea of moving water big distances, we've always looked to that as a solution. And the Chinese, for example, are building one of the biggest diversion projects as we speak, from the Yangtze River in the south up to the Yellow River area in the north in order to deal with their scarcity problems. But again, it's complicated from an engineering perspective and very expensive. So I think what I take from this is the importance of shifting our mindset here and saying, you know, water is limited. Can we do more and use water more productively in the local areas where we need it? And we've had this tendency to keep going out and looking for more supply when we get to, you know, to a point of needing more water in any given place. We go and look for more rather than looking for ways we can use it more efficiently, use it more productively, and begin to live a bit more within the limits of the local supply.
My guest, Sandra Postel, the founder and director of the Global Water Policy Project, the National Geographic Society's Freshwater Fellow, and lead water expert for the Society's Freshwater Initiative, and Dr. Upmanu Lal, the Allen and Carol Silberstein Professor of Engineering at Columbia University and the director of the Columbia Water Center. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about water on today's Please Explain It. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Some people also leave comments on our Facebook page. However you want to get to us. Just don't send me an email. I can't access that. Now, in the past, all the aquifers, the underground aquifers, would replenish themselves. But it's my sense that many of them are drying up. Are we just taking too much water out of them? Or has the whole hydrologic cycle been changed?
So,
well, if you look at, I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you look at our reliance on groundwater, it has really jumped enormously since about the 1940s, when we began to have the ability to, you know, have access to diesel energy and electricity to pump large volumes of water from under the earth. And if you look at the areas of the world, in particular important irrigation areas in North China, the breadbasket of India, Northwest India, the Western United States, much of North Africa, you find that groundwater is being pumped much faster than it's being recharged. And so even if these are renewable aquifers, we're pumping them out faster than nature is recharging them. And so water tables are falling. And in some places, they're falling as much as a meter or more a year, as they're doing in North China. And so, again, it comes to food. You know, remember, 70% of all the water we use globally goes to agriculture. So agriculture is the biggest user of water. And when I've added up the amount of overpumping to the extent we can get good estimates of groundwater overpumping, it seems to be, and this has been corroborated by some models in recent years as well, that as much as 10% of our current food supply depends on the overpumping of groundwater. So in a sense, the food supply today is in a bit of a bubble that's propped up by the overpumping of groundwater. And we know what happens to bubbles, right? The dot-com bubble, the housing bubble, they tend to pop. You can't sustain it forever. And so this, again, is a concern of water and food, in this case, the overuse of groundwater.
You wanted to add to that, Upmanu?
Yes. The thing is that the vast volume of fresh water that we have is actually below ground. But the rate at which we get replenishable water is dominated by surface water and atmospheric water. So in that sense, when you start using groundwater, you're mining a resource predominantly. And that is why the groundwater levels drop. Now, the thing that we've been looking at is working in India and China to address these problems. The story is exactly as Sandra points out. It is a food security issue that these countries try to address. But what we learn is that the vast quantities of water that are being pumped out are not being used efficiently at all. Whether you are in the United States or in Europe or in a country like India or China, because the price or the cost of extracting this water is not really evident to many of the users because of subsidies and other factors. So we've looked at two strategies. One is that could these people use that water more efficiently directly in the farms that they are farming and then end up in balance locally? And second, if the food were to be grown in other places in the same countries or in other countries, then do you end up with a sustainable strategy and also for both food and water? And the answer in both cases is yes. There are low-cost solutions available that can change the irrigation behavior of the farmers that can lead to, in the most water-using crops such as rice, 30, 35, 40% reduction in water use without really significant investment.
Go ahead.
And also, if you change the locations, you know, where you are growing different things or using water for different things, then also you can bring things in balance very quickly because you can grow these things in places where you don't really require groundwater mining.
Well, we've heard a lot in the last 50 years or so about making deserts into farmland. Is that counterproductive? Do we wind up actually creating more desert when we use up the water that's available there?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. You know, at first cut, sending water to the desert to grow things does not sound like a very good idea at all, and I don't necessarily endorse doing that. But there is a biophysical aspect to this that has to be kept in mind, which is that in a desert, you have ample radiation coming in from the sun and low humidity, both of which translate into higher yields if water were available and low disease for plants. So if you use deserts judiciously for high-value, high-yielding crops that use small quantities of water, then you could have very high productivity for those things. So it's a question of what you do, where you do it, and how you do it.
Should we take some calls? George from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. Yes, the current problem we have here in New York State and elsewhere in our country is that we're substituting natural gas through fracking for our groundwater supply, which means we're using something that gives people a lot of money initially today in order to use up our groundwater by fracking so that our children and our children's children and their children don't have the water supply. We're also having double the population in a very short order. We have 7 billion people now on Earth. In a short time, we're going to have 14 billion, which means that our water consumption is going to be that much higher.
Let me follow up on that. Fracking uses a lot of water. We use a lot of water in all sorts of different ways, manufacturing products. It's a coolant in nuclear power plants. Is all that water lost?
You know, we actually at National Geographic took a, you know, kind of an interesting look at the average American's water footprint. And what we found is that about half of the average American's water footprint comes from their diet. So we think about water, you know, when we turn on the tap, water comes out, and the water we see and use around our home is what we think about in terms of our water use. But if you think about the amount of water flowing through your lifestyle every day, it's about, if you're an average American, it's about 2,000 gallons of water that's sustaining your lifestyle every day. More than half of that is your diet. About a third of it is your energy use, so electricity, as you pointed out, Leonard, and your use of gasoline in your car and taking airplane flights. That's another third. And then the remainder is your household use and then your everyday material goods, your cotton T-shirt, each of which can take 700 gallons to make, your blue jeans, which can take 2,900 gallons to make, your cup of coffee each morning, which is 37 gallons. And again, not 37 gallons to make the coffee in your kitchen, but most of that, most of those gallons is to grow the coffee beans in Ethiopia or Mexico. So our everyday choices about how we use energy and how we can, what kinds of things we eat and what kinds of things we buy has a direct impact on watersheds and river basins all around the world. And this is where I think it's important to connect each individual's choices to what's going on in the world. We mentioned earlier that rivers are running dry. Well, that's happening all around the world, the Indus, the Ganges, Yellow River.
And we're building dams, aren't we? Are the dams counterproductive?
I don't think dams are counterproductive. You know, water needs to be stored. It would be very, very difficult, as the caller just mentioned, we're 7 billion people and growing. It would be very, very difficult to meet the needs of that many people without the ability to store water. All of Asia, 60% of the world's population is in Asia, which is a monsoonal climate, which means you have, you know, 2 or 3 months of the year that are very, very wet, flooding and so on, and then a long dry period. So we need to be able to store water, but it's a question of how we do it, where we do it, how we manage the dams that we do build, making sure that the river system itself gets the flows that it needs to sustain the life within it, as well as meeting our hydro and flood control and water supply needs. So I think we need to get smarter about how we build dams, where we build dams, and also how we manage them.
Now, Upmanu, are there innovations or technologies that will enable people to clean or purify water at a local level?
Yes. You know, they are energy intensive usually. So, again, it comes back to what energy sources you use and how accessible those energy sources are. For example, if you have access to solar energy, one of the things that is worth pointing out is that if you convert solar energy to electricity, you're looking at an energy conversion efficiency of 15 to 20%. But if you convert that to heat, that same efficiency can be 85 to 95%. So if you can then use that heat in purification, then you have a strategy that could emerge. So there are people working in that direction. And what I'm pointing at is distillation, and that is very energy intensive. But if you can capture the heat or condensation of the water as you get from water to steam and then back to water, to distilled water, then this process can become efficient. So that's one of the things people are looking at.
My guests are Dr. Upmanu Lal, the Allen and Carol Silverstein Professor of Engineering at Columbia University, also Director of the Columbia Water Center, and Sandra Postel, the founder and director of the Global Water Policy Project. She's also a freshwater fellow at the National Geographic Society. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We're trying to save the world today as part of a new series on Please Explain. And our first topic is water. We're talking about water on today's Please Explain as part of a new series that we're instituting. It's going to last about 6 weeks or so, and then we will know how we can save the world. That's the title we're giving to this series. Our guests are Sandra Postel and Dr. Upmanu Lal. And Mary from Westchester has written in. She says, do my guests have an opinion on the proposed desalinization drinking water plant on the Hudson River for Rockland County? It would be the first desalinization plant in New York State, and I wonder if you think that this would set a bad precedent for the northeastern region. Do you have any opinion about desalinization in general and whether it could possibly encourage more land use growth and not encourage conservation? Do you want to begin, Sandra?
Sure. Thanks for the question. It's a very good question because I often find people, you know, take the information we've given earlier in the show. We've got 97% of the planet's water in the oceans. If we could only get the salt out of it, we'd have no problem. And the problem is it's very expensive to take salt out of water. There are two basic ways to do it. You can distill the water, or you can push it through a membrane, which we call reverse osmosis process. Most of the plants now being built are this reverse osmosis process, and the membrane technology has gotten much, much better. So the costs have come down, but it's still a very expensive way to get drinking water. It's much more expensive than all the conservation measures we could name, pretty much. Now, that said, some places absolutely need desalinization to just get drinking water. The desert countries in northern Africa, many rely very heavily on desalination. Island nations that don't have access to other sources of water. But as a general matter, in most cases, conservation measures would be a much better way to meet needs than turning to desalination. The other thing is most of our desalination in the world today depends on fossil fuels for the energy. And so in some sense, we're creating more of the problem we're trying to solve if we turn to desalination to solve our water problems. We're really going to need, if we're going to deal with the energy, climate, water, food nexus of problems, we really need to look at solutions that don't make one of those problems worse while trying to solve another. And desalination really does that. It's making the climate problem worse while we're trying to solve the water problem.
Upmanu, as a listener points out, the total amount of water on Earth, including the atmosphere, hasn't changed since the planet began, but is more of it moving into the saltwater bodies of water? Was there more fresh water in earlier times?
No, I think, the main thing to keep in mind here is the hydrologic cycle. So it's a big solar still, and the amount of rainfall that we get overall on the planet balances the evaporation and the water that is returned to the ocean. So the fresh water that is generally available to us is a consequence of that particular process, and invariably the salts and other minerals that are dissolved by this water on its journey over land are what ends up at the ocean and are concentrated to some extent by evaporation. So that balance over the at least the last 1,000 or 2,000 years of human history on the planet has not really changed dramatically. And there are changes expected as part of climate in the amount of water the atmosphere can hold and in the intensity with which the rainfall and evaporation would exchange it. But in terms of what is accessible, the shifts are more in where rather than in the grand total that is there.
Amy from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hi. It was mentioned before that the highest percentage of water use is in food production. And I was wondering, I know there's a big difference overall for the environment if we eat meat or are a vegetarian. And I'm wondering if that applies to the water use. Is one more water intensive than the other?
Yes,
absolutely. It's a very good question. We've had roughly a tripling of world population since 1950, but meat consumption since 1950 has grown sixfold. So we've been, as a global society, consuming more meat as we get more income. It's one of the first things people do as they move out of poverty is begin to diversify their diet, and in particular, adding meat. So we've seen, for example, in China, as 300, 400 million people have moved into the middle class, they've begun to add a lot more meat to their diet, and that has pushed up their needs for the grain to feed the livestock to create the meat, and of course, the extra grain means extra water to grow the grain. So this is a big driver right now in the rising demand for water globally. And so I think if we think about the problem overall of how we're going to meet the water needs of 7 billion people and growing while sustaining the rest of life on the planet with a limited water supply, a finite water supply, certainly one of the things as individuals we could do is begin to shrink our water footprint by moving our diets a bit down the food chain. The average American takes about 5,000 liters of water per day for their diet, compared to 3,000 liters per day for the world as a whole. It's about 1 liter per calorie of food right now for the diet. But we're much higher than the global average. And so bringing our meat use down a bit would probably be good for our health as well as good for the planet.
Upmanu, maybe you can answer Linda's question, Linda in Warwick. She wants us to address the impact of the enormous loss of wetlands to development, which is ongoing.
Right. So the question is?
Is that another reason that we're having a loss of water because the wetlands are now being drained and houses are being built and hotels and...
Well, you're losing habitat for other species is the biggest impact of the loss of wetlands. As far as the flux of water on the planet is concerned, the oceans dominate the source of water. So that's the basic issue. And in terms of local areas, the major impact could be that as you remove wetlands, you also remove areas where a fair amount of water was recharged into the groundwater system, and that would be the negative impact in terms of local supply. But I think the biggest impact is an ecological impact.
A listener writes on Twitter that a pair of jeans costs 2,900 gallons of water to manufacture. Is that true?
It is true. Of course, it's going to vary from jean to jean, pair of jeans to pair of jeans, depending on where the cotton comes from. But as an average figure, yeah, that much water to make a pair of jeans. And that's because growing cotton in dry climates, where cotton is often grown, in the Indus Valley, in Pakistan, in Arizona, in our country, in other areas, often takes a great deal of water.
So it's not
just irrigation water. So to grow the cotton and then to take the cotton to the factory and produce the jeans, when you add it all up, it's an enormous amount of water for one pair of jeans.
But it's not just jeans. It's shirts, it's towels, it's anything that's made of cotton.
That's right, anything made of cotton. And most of the water used isn't at the factory, especially if you're dealing with a product that is either food or cotton. Most of the water use to produce that product happens out in the field. It's an agricultural use of water, and that's true for coffee. It's true for meat. It's true for all of these products.
Beryl from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I do understand the food aspect of it, but living in Manhattan, I mean, it seems taking long showers or running the water when I do dishes, it seems to me we don't have a water shortage here.
Our reservoirs are full. So should we be as concerned as somebody who lives in Arizona?
For the particular use that the listener is asking for, clearly we should be, on the water quantity basis, less concerned than someone in Arizona. But remember that if the water that you're using in the dishwasher or for showers, etc., is going on out through the system contaminated with the things that you've added to it, and then there is a cost to the city to clean it up before it is disposed of in whatever way that a particular place chooses to dispose it off. So you are creating that externality or cost, and so you have to worry about that.
Now, in the past, go ahead.
If I could just add to Imana's point there, I think New Yorkers have two things to be very proud of. One is that water use in the metropolitan New York area today is the same as it was 50 years ago, and that's because of conservation. There's been a very effective water conservation program around getting water-efficient toilets installed in homes and offices and commercial enterprises, fixing leaks in the water distribution system, these kinds of things. So if you look at the total water use for the greater metropolitan area of New York City, it's the same as it was 50 years ago, which is pretty remarkable. The second thing is New York City is the largest and one of the very few cities in the country that depends on unfiltered water. In other words, there's no filtration plant used to treat the water before it gets to New York, and that's because of the excellent watershed protection measures that are going on in the Catskills and the Delaware watersheds, where 90% of New York's water comes from. And so that watershed protection is extremely important. And getting back to the earlier caller's message about fracking, to be very careful about, you know, the contamination issue around fracking, because that watershed is a jewel for New York, and making sure that the quality of the water stays. New York has invested about $1.5 billion in watershed protection, and thereby has avoided the need to build a $10 billion filtration plant. So it's been good for the watershed. It's been good for the ratepayers in New York City. It's saved money. For those two reasons.
Doesn't the polluted water from fracking remain underground there for a very long time, maybe for the rest of the history of the world, kind of like nuclear waste?
Yes. Unless there is extraction and redistribution of that water, much of that remains there. But see, the concern is the groundwater is an ultimate resource. So if there were a major drought in this region, then and the population has gone up in the meantime, then you may have to tap that. So just like other sustainability issues, it's an issue of what do you want to mortgage for the future in terms of a future potential loss.
Now, we have very little time, but we have also talked on the show in the past about the possibility of wars over water in the same way that we've seen wars over oil. People are being charged in many parts of the world for their own water. Companies come in and buy up the resources. Do you see that as exacerbating the situation?
There's a lot of talk about wars over water, and there isn't that much evidence that that is the primary reason that a conflict will break out in some places. I think it could be an aggravating factor. People could use that politically when they are already inclined to conflict. A more important issue, I think, is that of economic conflict, because the water is so underpriced almost everywhere in the world that as the competition increases and the need to treat the pollution and the need to preserve the resources increases, costs will go up. There's no question about that. And that could start leading to competitive conflict.
You want to have a last word, Sandra?
Yeah, just to add to what Imana said, I do think that as water becomes more scarce and it gets harder to meet everyone's needs in any given location, there will be more tension and stress around water. I agree that we're not likely to see a lot of wars breaking out over water specifically, but if you just look at the trends we've seen in recent years where you do have riots breaking out among farmers when their irrigation supplies are cut off, You've got families up and moving areas because they don't have the water they need to support their
livelihood. Thank you so much, Sandra Postel and Dr. Upmanu Lal.